Welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
Hello, I'm Alan Saunders, and this is the Philosopher's Zone.
We will not simply look away, hope for the best, and leave the matter for some future administration to resolve.
Pitched battles went on for hours. The focus is Israeli...
Whether or not Yusuf Fortz could be ruled out.
Time is not on our side. The risk of inaction are far greater than the risk of action.
War, rebellion and terrorism continue to be inescapable features of the world in which we live. And together they constitute a major challenge. But it's not just a political challenge, it's also a moral challenge. So this week I'm talking to a moral philosopher, C.A.J. Cody, Professor of Philosophy at the University of Melbourne and Deputy Director of the Centre for Philosophy and Public Affairs, about his new book, Morality and Political Violence. When he came into the studio to talk about it, I wanted to begin with what he means by violence. I was struck by the fact that in the book he seems to think that the word force, as in phrases like military force, is something of a euphemism. We should be saying violence.
I'm pushing against the tide somewhat here, I think. It's become so established to talk of force, but I do think it softens the impact of what's actually going on in war and counter-terrorism and terrorism and so on. Force just suggests something a bit strong, but something which we can handle fairly easily, and I might, you know, pick you up and move you from this point to another point, and you're resisting, but nothing great goes on in terms of damaging you. Whereas violence is basically into damage, and it's basically into injury and harm. So whenever I hear people talking about, now it's time to resort to force, I think this is just a bit too weak for what they have in mind.
But in the case of war, I mean, the purpose of war is to force your will onto the enemy, and you can do that, can't you, without violence? I mean, isn't it sometimes the case that the purpose of an army is not necessarily to do violence, but to exert force by means of its acknowledged willingness to do violence?
Well, sometimes that's the case, of course. That's what lurks behind the idea of deterrence. But most of the time that won't involve what I'm principally interested in, the use of weapons, the use of explosions, the use of even weapons of mass destruction, as they call them, in order to achieve political objectives, not just standing around threatening, though if the threat is big enough and it's backed up by enough of this armoury, it'll get close to what I'm talking about. But normally we can force people to do things by all sorts of means that are short of violence, and people do. I mean, coercion is involved in the use of violence, but there are all sorts of non-violent means by which you can enforce your will upon others, as you were saying. So I want to distinguish those, though they've got an interesting connection with what I'm interested in.
If we think of the justification for the resort to violence, to military violence, one and something much discussed in recent years is the just war tradition, and there is something called the jus ad bellum. What is that?
Well, the jus ad bellum is a Latin tag. It's basically concerned with the justification for going to war in the first place. And under that heading, there are a whole lot of rules, principle of which, of course, is having a just cause. But there are a number of others, some of which I refer to as prudential considerations, like last resort. Moving to war should be reluctant. You should have reasonable prospects of success. Resort to violence should be proportional to the injury that's seeking to be addressed. And there's another condition about legitimate authority for going to wars. And then there's the jus in bello, which is concerned with how you conduct the war.
Well, I want to come to that in a minute, but I assume that one is not permitted to go to war in circumstances where you have not been directly threatened by the enemy, but you think that this enemy might turn out to be a threat, or that this nation might at some future date turn out to be a threat because it's building up an armoury and so on.
Yes. There's a distinction made between preemptive war and preventive war, made originally by Michael Walzer in his interesting book on just and unjust wars.
This is the American
American political theorist, yes.
Yeah.
And initially in that book, Michael made the distinction between preemptive and preventive war, and condemned preventive war. but allowed for preemptive war. And that echoes a good deal in the tradition. The basic distinction is to do with the immediacy of the threat. Preemptive war is when the enemy are massing on your borders and they've declared all sorts of intents to do this, that and the other unless you do something else and so on. And they're building up and building up. And the question is, well, look, why should I wait? They're about to come charging in here. If self-defense is, as I argue, one of the principal legitimate grounds for just cause, then surely I'm only defending myself really here because this threat is so imminent, it's so dangerous, and I can make it less dangerous by striking first. Preventive war, by contrast, is, as you were putting it, I think there's some kind of prospect that these other guys are going to do me an injury. They're going to invade some way down the track, or they're going to fire a missile at me some way down the track because, look, they've got some techniques for building missiles, or they've expressed political hostility to us in various ways and so on. And that's much more problematic, and I argue against it in the book. I argue that the philosopher Henry Sidgwick is right, that this sort of thing really quickly changes into guesswork, anticipation, some probability that, and it rules out all sorts of other ways of dealing with the threat, which are much more appropriate and much less likely to lead to dangerous and bloodshed consequences.
Now, it's all very well talking about the criteria which need to be fulfilled according to the doctrine of jus ad bellum if we're going to go to war. But if I'm not much mistaken, the last time the United States actually formally declared war on another nation was in World War II. And ever since then, we've had police actions, we've had special advisers being sent over, and a rather more serious engagement resulting from that. So do you think that in the sort of world in which we live, that prior discussion of these moral and political considerations is going to be rather lacking?
Well, I don't think the declaration issue is such an important one. What's more central to the point you're making is that you're suggesting that the criteria are pretty much irrelevant because they don't take any notice of them before they go off to war. I don't think that's actually true. I mean, what frequently happens, particularly with the Western powers, is that before the build-up to a war, there's a great deal of carry-on about the justice of the cause. There's a great deal of talk, particularly the justice of the cause, you know, but the not so much the other conditions, perhaps. The Iraq War is a good case of that. You know, it was a slow build-up to something that all of us saw, most of us saw, as inevitable. It was pretty clear that Bush and his cohort have made up their minds about this. But the justificatory procedure was very strong. And in Australia, for instance, in the parliamentary debates building up to the war, there was a great deal of carry-on about the weapons of mass destruction justifying the war, Saddam's intentions to do this, that and the other with them, some lesser references to building democracy and the vicious nastiness of his treatment of his own populations and so on. All of these were attempts at just war vindication, and sometimes explicitly so. You know, sometimes people actually did invoke the just war tradition. So I don't think it's true that it doesn't impinge upon political leadership. Now, you might argue they're being cynical and so on and so forth, but basically it's still there as a desideratum.
Let's look at the jus in bello, and I suppose we could basically call that the rules of war. It's the rules of the way in which war is going to be conducted once you've entered into hostilities. And there are, I suppose, at least two opposing attitudes to this. That's to say, attitudes of people who are opposed to this idea, to the idea of rules that mitigate the conduct of the war. We could call them the idealist and the realist. The idealist, the pacifist view, is that war is unacceptable and terrible, and that any attempt to make it less terrible serves only to disguise the unacceptable truth. The other view, the realist view, is simply that, yes, war is terrible and it should be fought with all due ferocity in order to bring it to a rapid conclusion.
Yes. Well, these are views I discuss in the book. Basically, I discuss three attitudes to war. Two of the three are realism and pacifism. The other is one that's not very much addressed, but I think is very pertinent in all sorts of ways, and that's romanticism about war. The realist doesn't think that war is somehow an intrinsically good thing. just necessary to achieve various objectives. The Romanticist thinks that war is intrinsically valuable. This is an extremely interesting thing that you had a lot in the 19th century with philosophers like Hegel. I have some sympathy with the pacifist view. I think that it's ultimately inadequate as a rejection here and now of all wars. Though it might be treated sympathetically, as I try to, more as an attempt to say we should get rid of the war institution over time. In the meantime, it may be that there have to be just wars, but we're moving to the point where that will be unnecessary by various institutional and so on changes. I don't have much sympathy with the pacifist who says, look, any talk about justifying war is really ruining our program. Any talk about that is minimising how bad it is and so on, and we should just be utterly opposed to it. I think that does ignore the fact that there are difficult situations in which, regrettably, the resort to violence is necessary. And in those circumstances, we do need to have conditions on how it is employed. As for the realists, I argue that realism is a much more complicated position than it's usually put. If it's put in the way you were putting it, it seems to me open to endless objections. I mean, there just are so many reasons not to go in for this idea that you just go hell for leather and then you win and that solves everything, because it doesn't solve everything. All sorts of things that have been done in the course of that are not only very clearly arguably immoral from the point of view of the sort of targets attacked, the sort of disproportional force used and so on, but they've also got very bad consequences, so that ought to be something that impinges upon the realists, since they are very often concerned with the outcomes and consequences of their deeds. They also, of course, build in, most of them, various considerations about you shouldn't go to war if you're not pursuing the national interest, for instance. When you unpack the idea of the national interest, it turns out to have a very high moral component, or can have, and not a very defensible one. It seems to me the national interest counts for something, but it can't count for everything in international affairs. If it did, we'd be rapidly in a sort of Hobbesian situation in which everything got out of control. I mean, Hobbes, when he's talking about state of nature.
Yeah, this is Thomas Hobbes, the 17th century English philosopher, who does talk about the state of nature as essentially a state of war of all against all. Yeah. Yes. On ABC Radio National, you're with the Philosopher's Zone, and I'm talking to Tony Cody from the University of Melbourne about morality and political violence. Just to return briefly to the really very curious and, as you say, somewhat neglected romantic view of war, the most extreme, or a most extreme expression of that, which you give in your book, is from Marinetti, the futurist artist, who says here, "We want to glorify war, the sole hygiene of the world. Militarism, patriotism, the destructive gesture of the anarchistic, beautiful ideas that kill, and contempt for women." Am I mistaken, do you think, in finding a sort of adolescent tone there?
No, not at all, I think. It's very prominent in Marinetti. But it's surprising how many of the people I cite glorifying war in this way throw in some reference to women as, you know, a bad thing. It's a strange combination, but it's connected, I think, with one of the driving forces of this style of romanticism, which is the glorification of activity, energy, risking life, finding yourself by this extreme exposure to danger and by inflicting dreadful violence upon other people and so on. And somehow that's got caught up with a kind of masculine picture. As you say, in many respects, a very adolescent kind of thing. Consequently, the whole soft side of life is just treated as being feminine and no doubt okay for raising babies and so on. But for the serious business of life, you know, not to be embraced. You find this running through a whole lot of these thinkers in the 19th, early 20th century. They become rather muted, except for the fascist movement, after the First World War, because that did bring home to people, I think, that this wasn't just a great glorified sporting contest in which the great activity went on, but it was a very incredibly dreary, depressing, bloody, and stultifying. So there was a big revulsion from it then. But I think it's still about in people's heads, you know. I remember a guy I had a conversation with at the university after the Vietnam War who'd been there, and I was saying some negative things about war and about the Vietnam War in particular. And he said, yes, that's all very well, Tony, but, you know, when you're in the trenches, you're testing yourself, you know, and it's such a rush, you know, you get this terrific charge and you... And I said, well, look, I can accept that something like that happens. And also people talk to the comradeship of war, sometimes in this romantic context. And I can accept that that sort of thing happens. But why should it happen only in the slaughter of other people and the exposing of yourself to not only your own death, of course, but all the misery that goes to your family and the rest of the people that love you? And William James, as I point out in the book, has an interesting essay called The Moral Equivalent of War, in which he tries to pick up the energising activity sort of story and say, yes, let's put it into other things.
Just before we move on from the romantic view, the great Prussian military theorist of the early 19th century, Clausewitz, is famous for saying, and there are various translations of the phrase, but war is the continuation of politics by other means. Mm. Yes. Do you think this is a blow against the romantic view, that he's trying to root war in politics and to say that the purpose of war lies outside war, it's not a self-justificatory activity?
No. Yes, I do. I have a somewhat ambivalent attitude to this statement of Clausewitz, but one element in it is precisely what you say. I mean, that it's treating war as instrumental, which is absolutely right, and which I think the romantic view doesn't. It's treating it as something that needs to be justified, and I think that's important too. And if he means politics in a broad sense, then of course there's plenty of room for my renovation of the just war tradition to take it on board and say, yes, indeed. But there's another element in the Clausewitz statement which makes war seem too normal, it seems to me. I mean, when he says it's politics by the means, well, there's this way of conducting politics, there's that way of conducting politics, and of course there's slaughtering all these people, which is a way of conducting politics. And I think that makes it all too normal and everyday and starts to move away from the idea that it needs some serious justification to the idea that it just needs a justification perhaps of the moment, you know, to do with politics right here and now. Whereas the drift of what I'm saying is that it's such a major human disaster in most cases, even when the wars are just, that needs a justification that goes beyond, as it were, normal politics, and needs quite a big justification in terms of serious moral thinking.
Turning to the idea of violence itself, you talk about the wide view of violence, the restricted view, and the legitimate view. What are they?
The wide view of violence is the idea best captured, I suppose, in Johan Galtung, the Norwegian sociologist's theory of structural violence, which takes violence not to be anything particularly concerned with the exertion of physical force in order to cause injury on people, by groups or by individuals and so on, and makes it much more amorphous, so that violence is going on whenever social injustice occurs, however the social injustice is actually brought about. So it's basically a move away from the means by which injuries are inflicted and says it doesn't matter about the means, it's any way at all in which people are disadvantaged. And then the legitimist definition, it's very popular in the United States, I think, is more a definition in terms of violence only occurs when force applied to injure people and so on is done illegitimately. And the illegitimately is usually cashed in terms of political illegitimacy, sometimes moral illegitimacy, but usually political illegitimacy. I object to both of these moves. The legitimists bring it about that the state can't be engaged in violence if what they do is legitimate, politically legitimate. But I think anyone who thinks that police who go around beating up demonstrators under a legal mandate are actually not engaged in violence hasn't actually been in a demonstration. You know, I think it's just a gross distortion of what we mean by violence. In the case of the structural violence, I mean, the legitimists tend to be people on the right because they tend to glorify the existing order. It can't be violent, you know, but revolutionaries, dissidents can. Structuralists tend to be on the left. They tend to be saying, what you're talking about, narrow violence, may be a bad thing. But look at all these other bad things. And Galtung himself said in his articles on this, if only we could get people to think of violence in this wide way, then we could mobilise everything, mobilise everyone against all sorts of things, you know, because we'd say they're all violent and everyone's against violence, therefore they would be against bad tax laws or whatever, you know. And well, I think this is a very sloppy way to go, you know.
Am I being violent by, in this broad sense of the word, yes, by my failure to act, by my failure to give money to third world charities, for example?
Certainly that's what some of the theorists who go for wide definitions would say, that if the injury that occurs or the damage, whatever it is, by bad tax laws or by other things, if that can be traced back to you in some causal way or perhaps some agency way, even if it was an act of omission, of not doing anything at all, then you're engaged in violence. And I think two things about this. I think, first of all, this way of thinking departs so far from what people ordinarily mean by violence, which is the restricted definition, I think, that it's just bound to lead to confusions and sloppy thinking. And the other objection I have to it is that it promotes a sort of political fantasy. I mean, I have a sort of left-wing objection to it. I mean, I think it makes people think that all social misfortunes and injustices and disadvantages have the one cause, that all of them are of the same style, and therefore you can solve them all with the one move. It's just not like that. Social realities are terribly much more complicated than that, and we should tackle all of them, but I think tackling violence and reducing political violence as much as possible is a project which has its own sort of logic, you know. If we mix it up with getting rid of hunger and various other horrible things, we just complicate the task and make it too difficult to address.
So the view of violence that you favour is the restricted view. Tell us about that.
It's just what I think is the normal view. It's the use of force intentionally to inflict damage or injury on people or on property. And I think that's a relatively clear notion. You know, it's not totally neutral. It's not totally non-normative because there's the idea of injury and harm built into it. But it's much more non-evaluative than the other two notions.
Finally then, Tony Coady, the view that you arrive at is what? It's a restricted view of violence and it is some support for the just war tradition?
In some respects, it's strong support for the just war tradition. I do think that the just war tradition has a lot to teach. The sense in which my support for the just war tradition is perhaps different from some other theorists, there are a lot of philosophers at the moment writing about this stuff, is that I take the view that just war thinking is very restrictive. I don't just take a restrictive view for violence. I take the view that just war thinking is very restrictive. It's not a license to go to war pretty often and so on. It's a form of saying, look, this is a dreadful business and we can't minimise the problems that it causes. So if you are going to go to war, you have to have very, very strong grounds, and most of the time the conditions are not going to be satisfied. Then if you do go to war, the conditions are also difficult to satisfy and have to be satisfied stringently. So it's restrictive in that sense. And in particular, if you look at some of the discussions I have of non-combatant immunity and a chapter I have on collateral damage, which I think is one of the really big problems in the waging of contemporary war, a lot of the things I want to argue are things that would be very critical and very difficult for lots of war-making policies at the moment in the world. So it's a stringent version that I want to put forward. And I do, as I said earlier, have some sympathy for the pacifist position in two ways. One, I think that the ideal of peace is an extremely important ideal, should figure in just war thinking, as it did, for instance, in Augustine. And it would put more restrictions on things. And pacifism, insofar as it's impressed by peace and is striving to eliminate the institutions of war eventually and so on, has my support. But I just think in the real world as it is, and as it may continue for quite a long while, we do need the just war tradition to deal with those circumstances in which war is the appropriate way to handle some very serious political problem. I think that's an important issue, and a further important issue, which I address very briefly in the book, but I'm working on now for a future thing, is what's called jus post bellum. And that's the idea of what kind of moral considerations apply to the ending of war and to the dealing with post-war settlement and post-war reconstruction and so on. I think that's an element in the tradition that's been rather neglected and needs to be dealt with.
Well, perhaps we'll talk about that later. Morality and Political Violence by C.A.J. Coady is published by the University of Cambridge Press. Tony Coady, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Alan.
The show is produced by Kyla Slaving, with technical production this week by Jenny Parsonage, and thanks to Melissa May in our Melbourne studio. I'm Alan Saunders, and I'll be back next week with another Philosopher's Zone.
been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.